Hi, this is Richard Edelman, and you're listening to The Trustmakers.
Hello, I'm Kirsty Graham, Edelman's US CEO. Welcome to a special three-part series of The Trustmakers, recording on the ground from the 2025 annual meeting of the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. We're speaking with media, with business and government leaders about what they're learning at this year's forum. We're also diving into the 2025 Edelman Trust Barometer, which we just released this week and marks Edelman's 25th anniversary of studying trust. Today, I'm thrilled to be joined by the Right Honourable Helen Clark, former Prime Minister of New Zealand from 1999 to 2008. She also served as the Administrator of the United Nations Development Programme. Now she's the patron of the Helen Clark Foundation and advocates for sustainable development and health equity. I'm honoured to call Helen a friend, and I'm delighted to have her here today. Helen, welcome to the Trustmakers.
Thank you.
It's great to see you here and to be on the ground in Davos, and what a week it is turning out to be, obviously with the backdrop of Trump's inauguration back in Washington. I know that you've been to Davos many times. What are you hearing at this year's meeting?
This is my 14th time at Davos.
Okay.
And a lot of the issues that were around when I first came are still around, but obviously the day we met, President Trump was sworn in DC. And so that becomes a huge focus of conversation. And I think those who come here are looking for insights into how others are going to navigate this transition, because it is a radical transition from the path that the Biden administration was on. For the rest of the world, we also see a United States back in an isolationist phase. And that is not new. They've been missing in action before. So I think, as Angela Merkel said during the previous Trump presidency, when President Trump showed less signs of being engaged with Europe than Europe is used to, she said, we're on our own. I think that is probably a bit of the sentiment from other parts of the world, just not expecting a lot, but knowing there's issues that have to be tackled and needing to get on with it. But of course, if you're Ukraine, for example, how the administration proceeds is of great interest. If you an American company which is under regulation or where the federal government has some interest, you'll be on tenterhooks at the moment. So everyone's gathering intelligence, I would say, at Davos.
I think that's a very good way of summarising it, of gathering intelligence. Talk at so many conversations around leadership, of navigating volatility. I know that you have worked extensively with the WHO. I know that you're very engaged, including this week, on climate sustainability conversations. There are some early indications of where this new administration is going on these issues. How do you read some of those early announcements that we've heard around both the Paris Agreement and on the WHO?
I chair two organisations which are hosted by WHO in Geneva, and I co-chaired the independent panel set up by WHO to report on what had happened in the pandemic response. So I've been very associated with WHO, even going back to being a health minister in the late 1980s when I attended the World Health Assembly. So, bottom line, the United States indicating that it wishes to leave the World Health Organization is not in the interests of the health of Americans, nor in the interests of global health. Why do I say that? It's because the WHO is the lead global health authority, and under it sit very important regulations like the international health regulations, which govern how we respond to pandemic threats. Here is the United States of America with H5N1 cropping up in quite a lot of places. Not yet sign of human-to-human transmission, but if there were, does the US want to fight H5N1 on its own, or does it want global solidarity and the whole system packing in? So this does not make sense to disengage from the international rules-based order in global health. It's as basic as that.
Fascinating. And you are right that even in the meetings I've been in today, there's still so much of a conversation around the lessons of COVID in terms of both leadership, in terms of, you know, the standing of science in our society now. Was that a tipping point on misinformation? What it meant about where people got their information? Do you worry about where science is? And when there's so much talk about AI, how do we make sure that in these huge global issues that people are looking at science and looking at fact?
It was very challenging during the peak of the COVID-19 pandemic, which has never gone away, by the way. It's still with us. But it was very challenging that we were in an age of misinformation, disinformation, information overload, everyone's opinion seemingly counting for as much as anyone else's, false facts, scientific evidence, everything became a soup. And for the person in the street, how do you sort your way through a soup or a fog? I think there are a lot of lessons to be learned by governments about communication in circumstances like these, because when this pandemic began, we operated not in a situation of perfect information, but of no information. We had no idea what the potential of this disease was to harm health, cause death. We learned as we went along. Leaders acting in good faith acted on the best information they had, but it wasn't always good enough. And that's what needs to come out in the reflections as countries do their analyses of what actually went on. I think we need to put a lot more emphasis on communication via peer groups that people do listen to. So I may be very skeptical about anything my government says to me, but if someone at my doctor's practice is telling me that probably, all things considered, I should be doing that, I'm likely to take more notice of it. Or if it comes through a youth influencer on TikTok, that's amazing the extent to which young people actually get all their information from TikTok. So there's just got to be different channels of communication appropriate to the peer groups.
So I'm fascinated you raised that because, well, two reasons. One, when we launched this year's barometer the other day, Gillian Tett actually made a very similar point, talking about the next generation and talking about how we say trust has gone local. But her point was, in this generation, the peer-to-peer relationship matters so much, and are we indexing enough on that? And when I think about in the height of the pandemic, when we did a report on trust and health, we found exactly the same thing. Some part of the population, you know, would turn to the National Health Authority for guidance, but almost an equal measure would turn to people they trusted, whether it was friends and family or people in their community. There was also a really alarming statistic at the time that I think it was for young people between 18 and 34, I think it was more than half believed they could be as well informed as their doctor by doing their own research on the internet. Yeah. When you think of the leaders you meet with and governments you're talking to, do you think government has recognised that media and where people get their information has changed as radically as it has?
If they're recognising it, they're not really acting upon it. So if I think back to the New Zealand response, and I was there in New Zealand locked down for 2 years with it, what we observed was that it wasn't until the response devolved through groups that related to communities, Māori Health Services, for example, with Māori Indigenous people, Pacifica Services with the Pacific people, being able to communicate directly with the migrant communities, then you could bring people into the response. I don't think in New Zealand we really got our heads around the youth dimension.
Yeah,
and the extent to which what was happening on TikTok would have had an influence. But we can learn from all this. You know, there's no 101. What are people listening to? Where do they get their information from? How do we get into those networks? Who do we link up with? Who are the partners? This is the way we need to be thinking strategically about communication now.
That is such a profound point when I think about the work we do at Edelman. And even in the Trust report, you know, we're looking at these four different institutions, NGOs, business, media, government. And if you look at how profound the changes and the extent of the challenges facing the world right now, you know, no one institution can solve any of them. And so this piece around who you work with, your partnerships, and how you communicate, I think is just a massively big issue for the world we now live in. I want to come back to the youth piece because I'm concerned what we saw in our report. But if we just talk about our 2025 overall report for a moment, you know, it was our 25th anniversary edition, launched here earlier in the week. And I think the headline is that the majority of people have a moderate or high sense of grievance. And we use that word quite deliberately because when we were looking at the findings, and Richard's spoken quite eloquently about this, that we saw fears a few years ago. Last couple of years, we've moved into a period of polarization, people being polarized in their views. And this year, we thought it's a sense of grievance. It kind of feels like a more aggressive mindset. And it's defined by a belief that government and business serve narrow interests and that the wealthy benefit unfairly from the system. So what was fascinating is that this sense of inequality, high income and low income both feel this. People in terms of their age also feel the sense of grievance. People are basically saying, the system doesn't work for me. Does that finding surprise you?
No. I listened to Richard Edelman's summary and I thought it spoke to a lot of the context in New Zealand, and I'm sure there were others from around the world who thought, yes, this is speaking to the context where I am from. I think COVID really fractured societies. You know, a lot of the underlying trends were there, but the social cohesion undermining that occurred out of the COVID responses has been quite profound. You know, people not trusting each other, government decisions which were seen as dividing people, even if made with the best of intentions. So populists, of course, are very skilled at scratching these itches at magnifying the fear and then the anxiety and then building the sense of grievance. What we know about populists, of course, is that they have a very simplistic diagnosis and even more simplistic solutions, almost all of which will inevitably backfire. For example, if you are aggrieved about the cost of living and feel that what's happened isn't fair to you, and then you're told that tariffs are going to be slapped on goods coming in, what makes you think you're not going to pay more for things at the supermarket or the hardware store? And there's a disconnect. But I think that we're in an era where incumbency in government is just about fatal to re-election.
Yeah.
Prospects. It doesn't matter how good or bad a government you thought you were. The fact that you've been there and the cost of living's up and a lot of things have gone wrong and people are out of work and haven't had pay increases, you'll get the blame for it. The next crowd that follow you may get the blame as well because they can't deliver. We may see a lot more short-term governments, one-term governments. In New Zealand, we haven't been so used to that. You know, 9 years has been not uncommon. But we may go into eras of one-term governments, and this may not just be the New Zealand context because people are angry, they're lashing out at whoever's in power, and the barometer can just swing. And in a way, it's nothing to do with ideology. It's how's this impacting on me? On me.
Yeah.
On me.
Yeah.
I'm
yeah.
not doing well. Yeah. So you are responsible. I'm going to take it out on you. But then if you don't deliver to me, I'm going to take it out on you and bring in the next crowd.
So I want to come back to the COVID fracturing society. You know, one of the other things we saw in the research was that one of the symptoms of having this high sense of grievance is also exactly what you described, almost a zero-sum mindset. 53% of people with high grievance said that they believed who people who didn't share their politics, whatever they were doing, came at a cost to me. So if you win, I lose. And that attitude means repairing polarization and instilling collaboration, whether it's local, whether it's regional, or even global, becomes so much harder. As a leader, how do you think about bringing people together? If COVID fractured society anywhere around the world, how do you build that back?
I think we really need some governments elected around the world who are, in a way, back to basics. I remember as a young political leader going on a tour of the US under one of the grants and speaking to people who'd been advising political campaigns. And what I recall is people saying, you know, public doesn't really expect much of governments anymore, but there's some things they absolutely want you to do. Their kids have got to be educated, and there's got to be some basic safety net that they can fall back on when times are hard. I think people aren't looking for bling in governments. They're not looking for excitement. They're looking for basic delivery. Is my income up to the living costs? Can my kids get to college? Can I afford the medical insurance? Is my housing affordable? And any government now that takes its eye off those basics is going to suffer, because people do feel hard up. They do feel pressed, even into, well into the ranks of what you might call middle class. Not only low-income earners, it's the double-income family that's feeling pressed.
So that data point you gave of, you know, back to basics is so interesting, because that was one of the findings. When we ask people, how do you feel, it's really a measure of economic optimism. I think it was Western democracies in particular, it was so low, lower than we've seen ever before. I think the highest was the US at 30. So I think you're really striking a chord in terms of delivering on those basics, irrespective of it's left or right. I think that's what people are saying.
Yeah.
Coming back to communication, you know, people see government leaders as legitimate when they think that the government does understand the people they serve and the needs that I have, that you are serving me. How do you think government needs to think about communicating with constituents in a time of a zero-sum grievance mindset?
An important principle I always operated on, and I think Richard Adelman touched on this very directly, was never overpromise. Because the worst thing you can do is you're getting elected because people are so fed up with what was there before. But if in your campaign you make promises that you're not going to be able to keep, you will let people down pretty fast. So building trust is a lot about transparency. If I'm elected, this is what I can do in a first term. I'd like to do more, but I can't see the way to that yet. But I can do this much. And better to have a bird in the hand than two in the bush. So never overpromise. Mean what you say, say what you mean. Don't say you're going to do things you can't do. And really, I think electors around the world are pretty sick of governments coming into power and saying, oh my goodness, there was a hidden fiscal cliff or a black hole or something. If they'd done their homework, they should know exactly what the fiscal situation is and not make promises which can't be accommodated within the envelope. So fundamentally, this calls for a lot more honesty in politics, a lot more transparency. And I think the public are looking for that. They want to be leveled with. They don't want a fairy story, but they want to know, what will you be able to do? Can you keep your word? Can I believe in you? Can I trust you at all? Because I've, you know, put trust in others before and it hasn't worked out. So I think it's really leveling with the public in a very basic way that I do mean what I say and I do believe I can deliver on it.
Again, I think that is exactly what we're hearing through the data, the sense of polarisation. But it actually, there's a question around whether in politics, and you could say even in the media, that there has been such a push over the last few years to the extremes, and that the vast majority seem to be saying, there's a lot to be done in the middle. Meet my basic needs. Don't blame the other guy, the other person, the other party, but show me that you are looking out for me. I think that's a very good point on transparency. And I know that when you were the administrator, UNDP, you spent a lot of time on poverty reduction. One of the other trends that we've seen for the last few years in the Trust Report is this increasing mass class divide. And by that, I mean that low income are far less trusting of the four institutions than high income. And we've seen the last few years double digit and a gap between that. From your perspective, what do you think is driving that? And how do institutions and leaders respond to this mass class divide?
I think for people who are really down on their luck. They don't know where the next cent's coming from. Why would they have any sense of trust in the institutions? Because it's not working for them, right? So in order to build trust, you have to ensure that the policies are inclusive, that there's a state for everyone in the society, that you're not going to leave people behind and say, oh, well, they made mistakes in their lives, that's tough, they've got to wear them now. No, you've got to try and create an opportunity corridor for everybody so that people think, yes, you know, my representative in Congress or Parliament or the Minister of so-and-so, whatever, they're looking out for me. And we know it's tough, but at least somebody's going to do something for us. I think that'll be pretty basic to rebuilding that trust.
And I guess you've seen that all around the world, that that's a point that I think so many people are making, because what we found fascinating with the data this year was it was so widespread. Yeah.
But here's another issue. UNDP had a report on these matters years ago, which I released, and one thing that stood out to me in it was the statement that the more unequal a society is, the harder it is to ever get reforms, because the poorest and most marginalised stop voting, they stop participating. So those who are campaigning aren't even thinking about them because they're not going to vote, so they almost don't matter. So where you have this huge stratification, people get left behind because it's really not in anyone's interest to campaign and advocate for them. Now, that, of course, is incredibly damaging to society if you take that approach, because if you leave people without work, without hope, can we be surprised that young people join criminal organisations? No, of course not.
But two other questions for you. One's around young people. You just said it. One of the most startling findings in this was around people who have high grievance, who feel the system is not working for them, more seem prepared to engage in what we termed hostile activism. And that is things like spreading misinformation, saying unkind or hateful things online, and in some cases even resorting to physical violence. And I think in the ages between 18 and 34, we saw over 50% of people thought that engaging in something like that was a way to get the system to notice. When you think about young people and you think about, I think they question capitalism a little more, you think about what's coming in AI and what that might mean for entry-level jobs, you think about the toll that I think some aspects of social media have played on young people's mental health. How do you think we should be thinking about the next generation? And what do leaders need to do?
That finding that 4 out of 10 people surveyed approve of hostile activism, I found the most disturbing finding in the whole report. And that 1 in 10 would support violent activism. This is very, very destructive. How did we get here? And it explained quite a lot to me about the way people behave on social media. I'm prolific on social media, and there is trolling, which I immediately block because I'm not going to give it a moment's thought. But the level of hate and venom that comes from people, that what is driving this? So where do we go to on this? Do we go back into our education system and think, and what messages are coming out of education? Do we need more values imparted in our education? This is a tricky area, but by values, you know, basic values like, you know, it's not all about you. You live in a society. We have obligations to each other. You know, if my neighbour's poor, I'm poor too. I don't steal, I don't do X, I don't do Y. Just basic values of looking out for each other and caring. I'll give you an example of something I found very touching recently. I was waiting to see a friend in a retirement village. And in the whole cafeteria area were children from the local school who were working on projects together with people in the retirement village. And these children came down to the school and sat with the older people, and they each exchanged ideas. I thought, we need to see more of that.
It was so
touching. And I thought, full marks to the school for making these links.
So that, to me, that is a profound finding. I don't think we talk about this enough, but it's surfaced in every breakfast or dinner I've been at this week, the sense that we're making rapid technological advancements, but we have to remember what it is to be human. Someone said, more FaceTime, meaning sitting opposite each other talking, less FaceTime, meaning the device. And I think there's something in there when you think about trust being local. And I think what COVID did to everybody in terms of isolation, physical isolation in a lot of places, certainly the mental outcomes, but the sense of returning to community, returning to something that is bigger than self, and that the social contract is fragile, but everything kind of depends on people believing in it to a certain extent. My last question then for you, you've done so much, and I'm deeply respectful of all the ways you have given in public service. As a leader, and in these times of incredible challenges, and of multiple challenges at once, and volatility, what do you think it takes? What do leaders need to be thinking about in terms of the attributes they show in a time like this?
Definitely empathy. And that was why, by and large, women leaders did quite well during the pandemic. There were men who showed empathy as well, but it was a characteristic of the women's leadership. So leaders have to be obviously understanding of the pressures that people are under. And then I think the best leadership will be calling for inclusion and ways of bringing people together around the common cause for the country. How do we all get ahead together? We can't get ahead if we leave many people behind, if we leave whole demographics behind. So appeal to that sort of greater sense of we're in it together. Why do we care about education for everybody? Because if we leave people behind, we're going to have people who are unemployable at a time when we need skills and educated people. So just find the messages that will bring people together, not polarize them. And I think, unfortunately, we see a lot of leaders deploying rhetoric that is designed to divide, not to bring people together.
I could talk to you for much, much longer, Helen, but I know that we are out of time. I just want to thank you for your insights, for the breadth of issues we've covered, and for your huge global experience across so many issues. And to our listeners, can I just say thank you very much for listening to The Trust Makers. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you for tuning into The Trust Makers, an Edelman podcast in partnership with Advertising Week, where we speak with leaders and other trust builders across institutions. See you next time.